Listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is the New York composer Michael Rouse, who has been closely associated with the John Cage Trust for well over 20 years. We've just heard a few of Michael's sound samples created for his original sound score for our theatrical realization of Cage's James Joyce, Marcel Duchamp, Eric Satie, and Alphabet, which premiered in Edinburgh in 2001 and then toured much of the world over the ensuing few years. We speak this evening about this and other of his endeavors with both the John Cage Trust and the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. Welcome to All Things Cage, Michael. It's a pleasure to see you.
It's great to be here.
How long has it been since we've actually been together, which we're not now?
Wow. It's been, I honestly can't remember. I feel like we saw each other at the Maritime Hotel when you came into town. You know how everybody said it was going to be, we're going to think about COVID as before and after? What I've discovered is that, and maybe it's my age, that I can't remember if something happened during COVID or not. And so I have a feeling that we saw each other at the Maritime during COVID, but it could have been just before.
Yeah, no, I think it was during, I don't know why I say that. Did we have Japanese food from the restaurant downstairs?
I feel like we had takeout, yeah.
Yeah, in my room, I think we had Japanese. So that kind of would maybe speak to COVID, maybe.
Yeah, actually that makes sense.
Yeah. Anyway, but it's really nice to be with you anyway. And I'm going to see you soon because we're going to have lunch.
Yes.
One of our kind of marathon lunches soon.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
That's when everyone will know the city's back.
That's right. They'll say, I saw Michael and Laura at Pastis. I saw them.
That's correct.
For our audience, there's a little bit of, I may repeat myself a little bit after my introduction of you, but you know, Michael, we have known each other probably for 25 years.
Yeah, we met in, I know exactly when we met, which was after the premiere of Dennis Cleveland in 1996 at the Kitchen. I was so broke that I had to do myself a benefit at a church that had a theater around the corner from where I live in Hell's Kitchen. And I think Fran Richards had told you to come.
That's exactly right.
And I can't remember if I met you that night, but definitely Fran told me to reach out to you. And then we met. And I do remember a wonderful conversation at the old Film Center Cafe, which was right next to Rudy's, which is my dive bar in Hell's Kitchen. And you asked this really interesting question that only a couple of people ask, which is, in effect, it was, so, Johns or Rauschenberg? You know, meaning like, what was your proclivity? You know, and I just thought it was such an interesting question because at various times in my life, it's been one or the other, you know?
What is it now? You said Rauschenberg.
I saw the Johns show 3 times. So yeah. That's pretty fantastic. And I, you know, I always kind of wish, you and I talked about this a lot over lunches. I always kind of wish I was more like John and Bob in terms of a certain kind of zest for life. And I kind of think I'm a little more like Merce and Jasper. which is probably
Michael, do you remember it was a time when you and I were with Merce and we were in the kitchen and other people were coming to dinner and Jasper came.
Yep.
And when Jasper came over that particular day, I had spent the day in Washington, D.C. with the American Music Center board members for something. Okay. And they were trying to, the government was trying to, the NEA was trying to get rid of funding to individuals. Do you remember this?
I remember that time period with the NEA for sure.
Exactly. And I was ranting about it. And we as American Music Center people, we couldn't go over and cast our vote against it because we got some sort of honorarium or something from the government. And so therefore we were on their nickel and you couldn't like leave your station and go to some other station and vote.
Okay.
And, you know, anyway, and I remember coming back to Merce's that night, you came over a little bit early to have a drink with me and Merce, and you and I were ranting about the NEA and about the time that we live in. And Jasper walked in the house and sat down next to Merce and listened to us talking and just sat there staring at us. And then he looked at Merce and he said something like, yes, well, it was so much easier when we were young, wasn't it, Merce? You know, he's being sarcastic.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, every generation, I'm sure, feels that it was much easier on the people before them and will be easier on the people after them.
Yeah. Well, I have some bad news. I have some bad news for those people. It's not going in that direction.
Anyway, so we've known each other for a long time. And, you know, I want to say the first, how I remember it, Michael, is I came, Fran Richards did indeed insist that I come to your fundraiser. Mm-hmm. Which I did. And I couldn't believe, and I told you this because we didn't talk that night. You almost blew me off that night because I came to say hello to you and you had all your fans were there. And it's like, oh yeah, hi. But then I think Fran yelled at you and you called me up and wanted to meet for a drink. We might have even gone to Rudy's or something.
Right.
And I told you that I thought that you were really the most exciting composer I'd ever met or heard of my generation. That was number one. And number two, I couldn't believe that I had never heard your music. Like, how was that possible?
You did say that a number of times in the early years, like you couldn't kind of believe that. But I just think it's easy to fly under the radar. And, you know, the funny thing about that, the time that we met, it was, it's hard to remember this now, but when we did the premiere at the kitchen, we did like a 2-week run at Dennis Cleveland, but they had run out of money and I think they were firing their board or all sorts of stuff was happening. And so not that they were ever used to it, but they didn't prepare to extend a run. They didn't have the facilities to prepare for an extended run. So prior to all the touring that Dennis Cleveland did over like a 12 to 15 year period, at that moment, more people had heard or read about the show than actually had seen it. And, you know, the people who came out for the benefit, some of them might've been confused thinking they were seeing excerpts of that. It could have been any number of things, but I just thought, well, this is really interesting. It's like all these people are here for this benefit because they've read about this show, but they're not seeing anything to do with this show.
Yeah, you did. As I recall, you did things from Failing Kansas.
No, from Living Inside Design.
Oh, that's right. Oh, even better. Even better, because it was this really kind of...
With a fantastic video by Cliff Baldwin.
Exactly. It's just, that was marvelous. It's still to this day, my favorite of your CDs. Yeah. American Dream too, I suppose. Yeah. But they were like the kind of the more pop Michael Rouse.
Yeah.
Than the others, even though, and I never saw Dennis Cleveland at Lincoln Center until we performed it.
Yeah, I think that's correct. In fact, you were in the, if I'm remembering correctly, you were in the first performance is After the Kitchen, which was at least 2 years later in Los Angeles, Orange County, Eclectic Orange, Dean Corey's.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And I feel like that would have been, I think that was either 98 or 99. It took like 2 to 3 years for it to come back around. 98 or 99. So there was this big delay. I don't want to go into Dennis Cleveland, but there was this big delay because Fred Zola was interested in taking it off Broadway.
I remember.
And so that just took up, that ate up just like an entire year of poverty, you know, trying to see if that was going to come to fruition. And then we were actually, you know, the plan was to go into the Selwyn after the Wooster Group's Harry Ape with Willem Dafoe. And then it just, all the theaters got triple booked and it was just, we couldn't get a theater. It was just, you know, one of those sad stories. But ultimately, you know, that led to me working with Michael Mishala, who became my booking agent. And we had this great run, as you remember.
I do. And Sue Devine from ASCAP became your great champion.
Yeah, she was awesome. And she brought the hot dogs that saved the day, because we were really struggling with trying to remount this production after a number of years of not doing it. And she knew of my love for Pink's chili dogs in Los Angeles. And so I think that she brought like 100. And we were all sitting out there on picnic tables in the loading dock. And I think John Jezrin, who was the video designer for the original production, said, I think this may have turned the tide or saved the day or something. And I think it did. I think that we just needed a shot of goodwill.
Yeah. I told you I saw him at the Foundation for Contemporary Arts.
Yeah.
He came over to me and said, do you remember me? I said, yeah.
I hope he's well. I haven't seen him in years.
He looks fantastic. He's lost a bit of hair. Mm-hmm. But he looks fantastic. He looks he looked happy, and you know, he looked healthy and happy.
Good.
Yeah. But I remember many conversations with you about the plight of composers in New York City in that whole period. It was a very difficult time for all of you.
Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, we, as you and I got to know each other, it was, I just felt like they were, it was such good fortune on my part, because you were always game for things, game for ideas. You know, we came up with the CD-ROM of the prepared piano sounds, which allowed me to turn you on to Eisenberg's, the best tuna fish sandwich in New York City.
And tomato soup. Don't forget about the tomato soup.
Because we were recording around the corner from there.
That's exactly right.
And that just kind of, and I was doing, you also tossed me some really wonderful archival work with the Trust, which I thought was fantastic. And, you know, kind of got to do a deep dive on, and, you know, and similar to, you know, the archival work I did for Arthur Russell, I feel like both of those things, you know, I could not have known this would happen, but both of those things were instrumental for when the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts took my archive in 2010. And I was like, oh, well, I kind of knew, you know, between working with Michael Reisman on Arthur's archive and then working with you with Cage stuff, it was like, oh, I kind of know how to do some of this, you know?
And you did it beautifully. I mean, you did all of it. You, Michael, for our listening audience, Michael really was almost single-handedly responsible for stabilizing the really kind of archaic archival materials and media. Like, you did all of our reel-to-reel transfers. You know, we have all those reel-to-reels still, but they have absolutely no purpose because, you know, other than being really beautiful doorstops. But,
Well, but I will add to that, having worked on transferring all my analog recordings and digitizing them for the archive, the tape format turns out to be a lot more robust than people thought. Mm. And since digital formats seem to keep changing, so rapidly, I'm not so sure.
No, I think you're right. We still have, we still have some cassette tapes.
Yep.
That, Cage and Cunningham, people are so fussy about archives, know, white gloves and, it's light and all this stuff. Cage and Cunningham lived in that condo on the top floor of a building.
Yeah.
Full of dirt and dust. No air conditioning, so there was no air, purification going on.
Right.
And we still have cassettes that are functional.
Yep. It's an amazingly robust format. And I archived, maybe 300 or 400 of my own cassettes to digitize them and sequence them. And I was pretty amazed. Once in a while one would fall apart and I could figure out how to take it apart and and put it back together and whatever. But I was pretty amazed by that.
Did you ever bake one? Somebody had told me that sometimes you had to bake them.
Yeah, there was not the cassettes, but there was a time in the 80s where BASF tape. It was one of the standard 24 track tapes and mastering, both half inch and quarter inch tapes. And they had, if I remember correctly, they had decided to start using a different backing, the glue part that the magnetic part goes to. And that turned out to not be such a good thing and they would deteriorate. So when even before I knew I was going to do my archive in 2007 or 8, I finally had the money to take most of my analog masters and have them digitized. And almost all of them had to be baked.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that we ever went through that with anything.
Yeah, because the problem was, the reason that you're baking it, if I understand this correctly, is because the tapes would shed. You know, they wouldn't, like you'd play a tape and then you'd see all of this magnetic deposit on the tape head.
So
because it wasn't adhering to the adhesive the way it used to. So the idea of baking it was that it would adhere. And then sometimes you could get more than one play, but theoretically, you might only get one more play after the baking.
I see. So you better get it right.
And I went to a place called Dream Hire. Mark Berger did all of my analog masters. I met him through Bill Tessar at Toy Specialists.
So let's move you into Cage Cunningham for this show, because you've done some amazing projects. We've done amazing things together. Some of which I've already talked about in the show. That doesn't mean we can't at least mention them.
Yeah.
And the first one I think that we did together, Michael, still is probably the most important. And that was the realization of Alphabet as a theatrical, as a staged work.
Uh-huh.
That was, that got a lot of stage time. We took that all over the world.
Yep.
It was really pretty amazing when I think back at how we did that. That was Michael Mushala,
mm-hmm.
who was with, what was the name of his, he was with, who was he with at that time?
He was, by that point, he had left CAMI.
You think he had left CAMI?
Yeah. And so he was, his company is Double M Arts and Events.
Oh, that's right. And it was Double M then. Never mind. Yeah. So I was thinking he was still with CAMI when we did that together.
Yeah.
Yeah. He also, talk about, being game.
Yeah.
Michael Mushala was also really game whenever we wanted to do something.
Yep. He was always very curious and always willing to help. So.
Yeah. Well, we did this show and the stage version of Alphabet, as I played a bit of it on the air and talked about it. But Michael, you were key to that, because you were not only the person who, you made the soundscape, which had never actually existed.
Uh-huh.
Remember, Cage had left some things in notation, but it had never been fully realized with sound at all.
Yeah.
And Michael went in and created really the relevant sounds and the irrelevant sounds, so to speak. as left in just manuscripts by Cage. So he worked with a whole team of people in Louisiana, I want to say. You were in residence in Louisiana?
Yeah, I was doing a 3-year Meet the Composer residency. So I enlisted a lot of students and faculty, and we also I had them looking for Australian bird sound in Australia, like whatever you know Cage had called for the irrational sounds. And then he had these rational sounds, which were, as you know, very different for Cage, because since it was a radio play, even though some of these things were more humorous than a typical radio play, they were triggered by the dialogue, meaning
exactly.
And so then we also collected all those sounds and then put that on a sampling keyboard. And then I would follow the score. I'm also playing and reading the role of James Joyce, but I'm also following the score so I can do the triggered sounds.
Right, exactly, which were the rational sounds.
Yes.
I always remember John Kelly, who was our only moving about character. He was our narrator, so to speak. That was his name. And that narrator, I always remember that one little place about the rational sounds where he says, "The telephone rings, and then the telephone rings." So it's as he says it as if he's responding to it, except it came after, and it was supposed to come after.
Yeah,
and it was just incredibly cute.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, it was good fortune, you know, because like Merce and John and I guess pretty much everybody else had to kind of memorize a lot of text.
Almost and everybody did. You had a keyboard in front of you, so you in
theory, I had a cheat sheet.
You could have a cheat sheet. Merce, you remember what happened with Merce?
Yeah.
It all happened after our dress rehearsal.
Right.
It was pretty awful, where he could not remember his lines.
Yeah.
And then when he did remember them, he would do them too fast.
Yeah.
And this whole piece was like clockwork. It was all connected to a sound score that was ongoing, the irrational sounds.
Right.
And Michael trying to fit his rational sounds into the dialogue. And there was Merce not being able to get that straight.
Yeah.
Remember what we did? It was so clever.
I think we took him into the recording studio and we recorded his parts. And then we would kind of use that live recording, not only as a way to kind of help him with his lines, but also to address the issue you just mentioned, which was to keep the timing correct.
That's exactly right. And, you know, my hope for it, as I told him, and he was a champ. He went into the studio and he did that flawlessly. It was perfect what he did.
Yeah.
Reading it, of course, at that
point.
But I said, you know, Merce, this is a really great opportunity for you to be choreographic. You know, because anytime you don't want to do your lines, don't do your lines. We can hear them.
Yeah.
And go ahead and play with your feet or brush your arms around or do what you want. And he still hung on to trying to keep up with that tape. Merce, for those who don't know, Merce Cunningham played Eric Satie. And Eric Satie, as a humorist, if you will, they were non sequiturs.
Okay, yes.
Everything he did was a non sequitur, so there was no way for him to really hang on to what his next part was going to be, because it launched into a cup of coffee, or then it went into a piano, or it went into, and he you could see it in his face as he was performing, because as the tape was rolling, you could see in his face, oh, that's right, that's this part.
Yeah. And he got the most laughs. You know, like, I mean, I guess John gave Satie kind of possibly for his admiration for Satie, but he gave him some pretty good lines.
Those are all Satie's lines. Those are things.
Are they really?
Yeah, everything. That's Satie. Everything. Satie.
I knew that some of the stuff was like, you know, the Rose C'est La Vie stuff and that stuff was. But
no,
I didn't
Satie,
know that
all quotations, all of it.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. And I did about Alphabet was with John Kelly, who played the narrator.
Okay.
And you remember John had a really long monologue that was pretty dry, and he was having problems with that. And I ended up I told him to sit down at the front of the stage on the floor, and I gave him a newspaper into which he had taped
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. He was able to turn the newspaper as if he was idly reading the news, but there would be yep. his next cue for what.
Yep. No, that's that. I completely forgot that.
Yes. You probably didn't forget your sound effects.
He was all fantastic. Your
sound effects.
Yeah. Yeah. The fart was good.
But anyway, that was the first thing really that we did together of any real substance.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but also the prepared piano. I mean, isn't that one of the first things? Didn't that?
Not one of the first. That was after Alphabet.
Really?
Yeah. I'm going to look up the date.
You might be right. It's a good question.
Oh, it's the same year. It was the same year.
Okay, that's it. Wow. Yeah, then.
So they were right around each other.
Wow. So we were busy.
Very, very. That was a really crazy time, actually. But that was the same year. I bet it was before, Michael, because Alphabet premiered in 2001.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, at Edinburgh, I believe. Edinburgh.
Right, in Edinburgh. And Berlin was second or third stop, and that was 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So maybe not. Maybe they were around the same time. Who cares? It doesn't really matter.
But yeah, so those two things, if they happened around that same time, they were pretty significant. And I was so excited about the crazy recording session that we had to do to record this sample library that, you know, sounds pretty standard now, but at the time, you know, was kind of a newish thing, or certainly for me, certainly with I'd done a lot of records, certainly the strangest recording session I'd ever been involved in.
I see Nurit Tillis from time to time. Nurit was our pianist.
Yeah, and she was fantastic.
She had unbelievable patience because her job was to play every note on an 88 key piano,
yeah,
prepared or unprepared,
yeah,
in different iterations. Right. So Michael needed it. Michael was our session producer.
Michael
Sear. I think Larry Larson was our project producer.
Yeah, and then Michael Sear was our engineer.
That's right. That's right.
And for those who understand the different digital technologies, we weren't yet recording onto computers, or at least the standard thing that we were doing was recording to DAT.
Right.
And we recorded to, there was another type of tape machine. It might have been the Tascam machine. And we wanted to have both options of 16-bit and 24-bit. So we ran two different machines. And then all of the cataloging I had to do to put that together was from the DAT tapes, as opposed to having, like, you know, a computer screen where you could see all this stuff laid out.
Right. It's so crazy when I think back on it, how absurd it all was.
Yeah, absolutely. And but, you know, it got such a great, there was a review from some really important music magazine, and it was the only time, let's say it was around 2001 or 2002, it was the only time they gave a 5-star rating to a piano sample library. All other piano sample libraries up to that point had only gotten 3.5 or 4, because a piano is a really hard thing to do right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then of course for me, as much as I was into the idea of it being available to people who wanted to play Cage works but didn't have the ability or wherewithal to prepare a piano, I was obviously thinking about what other composers might do with this. And, you know, I used it probably on every other record for the last 20 years because the sounds are so amazing. And I also find, you know, it's, I don't know if you and I have ever talked about this, but I'll be minding my own business watching some film or something, and because I know those sounds, you know, like the back of my hand, I'm like, oh, I guess that composer found the sample library. You know,
that's exactly right. What's his name? The very, very famous, Leonardo DiCaprio. Remember, it's Shutter Island. It's
used
in Shutter Island. A couple full songs are used in Shutter Island.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No, I knew, I kind of knew it would be a resource, you know, it was just like, you know, not going to be anything quite like it. And I think, you know, also our timing was good because people were definitely using more sample libraries for things. So all of a sudden there were these these sounds, and we gave them so many options in terms of legato, in terms of staccato.
Exactly. Yeah. So they didn't have to do really anything to what we provided to them.
Yeah.
Those sounds, we then turned around and used those sounds in the prepared piano app, which, yep. You know, the Larry Larson likes to say that, well, we didn't make a dime really on the prepared yep. piano app. He yep. said it was the first time in his life that he'd ever gotten close to being a hero, close to being like number one, because well, that's awesome. Watched that app bounce up.
Yeah. You know,
it stayed up in that territory for weeks.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
we were going to actually crash the whole rating system.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure people were thrilled to have that. You know, not everybody who's going to be using a CD-ROM sample library, obviously composers, musicians, people like that. But the fun thing about what you and Larry did with the app is that everybody's downloading apps, so everybody could have access to this. And
right.
just,
yeah. people write and want it. They want it to be more than it is.
Yeah. You know,
they want it to be something that they can use in performance. They want to be able to share recordings that they make, save them, and send them to other people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they just really don't understand the complication of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, you know, you could always make the argument, well, that actually does exist. It's just on the CD-ROM.
That's exactly right.
But, you know, so many people use the phone now, you know, in such exclusive ways that I could imagine, you know, they want it all in one place. You know, they don't right. want to have to do that. And they don't want to have to hook up a sampler or go to their computer to run a keyboard to play the samples. So,
yeah. Well, you used them. I mean, going back to your music, Michael, you used a lot of those prepared piano sounds and the music we're going to play today, which I really want to get to and be able to play enough of it for people to hear. And that's your piece that you describe it. It's a piece that Michael wrote for Merce Cunningham. We're talking now, what was the date of that?
That premiered in New York in 2006.
Six. Okay. So that's, you know, not so long after that. It was a Merce piece called Eye Space. And Michael's piece was called International Cloud Atlas.
Yeah.
After the book title, after yep. the book.
Yep.
So yep. talk about that. It's just, it was so creative and so amazing.
Well, the most amazing thing to me was having gotten to know Merce through you. And then, of course, I was married to Lisa Boudreau and she was a dancer with Merce. And, you know, maybe some people don't know this, but, you know, the fact that they would rehearse without music, you know, and that even the dancers themselves wouldn't hear the live music until the opening night of the performance. And I thought that was really fascinating. But as I learned from getting to know some of the dancers and hanging out at Westbeth when they're rehearsing and stuff, you know, they built this incredibly accurate internal clock, you know, like Merce would basically use a stopwatch. You know, and you were off by 30 seconds, but not from any beat or sound that was happening. So that was kind of remarkable to me. But a lot of the music that traditionally was used in Cunningham performances, you know, didn't have repetition, didn't have a driving beat or a pulse. And so I thought, you know, how could I ever really, since so much of my stuff does, how could I do that? And so, of course, when you guys approached me with the iPod, I thought, this is perfect, you know, because everybody can have an iPod set to shuffle, which to me was like the sort of the Cage Cunningham aesthetic on steroids. And I could do whatever I want because it's not going to interfere with the dancers, to which when I told Lisa the idea, she goes, great. So you finally get to write music for Merce Cunningham and I don't get to hear it. But it really let me do crazy rhythmic things that I don't think would be appropriate in most cases for the Cunningham aesthetic. And we did do, working with Stephen Moore, who was fantastic, we did come up with an idea. This was also a suggestion of Lisa's, but we did come up with an idea because we kind of figured there might be a lot of people, especially devotees of Merce of a certain age, who might not want to fumble with an iPod in a live situation. So we came up with a sound score that basically was, at least for me, emulating what it can sound like to walk with your iPod or your iPhone through a city. So every time we'd go to a city, like when we went to Paris, we would add those sounds to the live performance, and then play those in the pit. trying to keep it, you know, not to be too overbearing so that people could really have the internal experience of their own individual iPod or iPhone or whatever, you know.
Right. And let me interject one thing here, Michael, just to make sure that our listening audience is following this,
yeah.
That, you know, for the first time you had Cunningham dance on the stage and every single person in the hall was listening to something different than the neighbor. So everybody was hearing something different all at the same time, which is.
And the thing that was fun for me, because again, I didn't do the entire tour because I was touring some of my own pieces, but I did a lot of the shows with Stefan in the pit. And the thing that was interesting to me right from the get-go, from the first premiere at the Joyce, was people coming up to us and saying, how did you manipulate my iPod? And I go, well, we didn't manipulate your iPod. And they go, but I'm telling you this, but see, the thing is, because my music was so propulsive and had so many beats, you know, chances are they were going to land on a number of them. And but I always thought the thing I liked about the idea of the iPod shuffle piece was that it's, and similar to, you know, other pieces I've done, I like the idea that the audience is kind of a collaborator. So I felt really excited about the fact that they were bringing this thing. They were bringing these connections that were completely their own creativity, because how could we possibly know what, you know, what was, you know, you're sitting next to one person who's hearing a folk tune and the person next to you is hearing like this really crazy propulsive, you know, almost Kana Nankara like use of these digital prepared piano samples.
Exactly. And talk about the content of that piece, because that is equally as interesting.
What were
the elements that you made use of?
I wanted to use the prepared piano samples in a different way. So I thought a lot about Giorgio Moroder, and I thought a lot about Kana Nankara. And so I used them in very, very quick, repetitive sequencer passes and stuff where it just kind of made these growling noises because they were moving so fast you couldn't quite comprehend them. And then I wanted to include all the dancers. So all the dancers came to my studio and did some kind of contribution on the record. And I had lots of collaborators. My friend Mark Lambert and his wife Susana Ribeiro came and translated some of my lyrics into Portuguese and made some of these beautiful sort of Portuguese singing and translation to the music. And I think Cedric, one of the dancers, did some French translations of lyrics, you know. So it was kind of a collaborative piece. And I knew that the dance was going to be something like 20 minutes. So I made at least an hour because I wanted to have way more material than would be needed so that, you know, the permutations that would be available to the audience members would be something really, you know, wild. And, you know, an unintended thing that I'm really proud of is because I could totally imagine some people could have thought, oh, it's a gimmick, you know, everyone's, you know, the iPod was kind of maybe not new, but it was not as ubiquitous as it is now. And I remember when I was first testing it out, I think we were in Italy, like the company was touring. I wasn't with them, but I was with them. And I was listening to some of the tracks that I've been working on. And just laughing at this rehearsal, watching this rehearsal, because it was just so effective, you know, it was like beyond my wildest dreams. But once you're in a theater with 1,000 people, you know, you're asking them to do something that is really weird, because you're wearing headphones in a theater and it feels a little like, you know, John Rockwell described it as being the ultimate in intimacy, but I found it disturbing, like, do I really want to be in a room full of people and not be able to understand what's going on around me? Because now I'm cutting off this very important sense. And that for me gave it attention that I thought was really fantastic, but unexpected because it never occurred to me. I've been walking around with cassette Walkmans and stuff for 20 years in New York. And that never occurred to me how that displacing that inside a theater would be so different.
Right, right. And it really was. I mean, it was wild. It was actually kind of wild. And I think that, you know, going back to Merce personally, it didn't take much to convince him to do this.
Yeah.
But he was shocked and yeah. how effective it was, how yeah. you know, how marvelous it was. Marvelous. He thought it was marvelous.
I remember seeing him at the Joyce for the premiere. I remember seeing him in the wings with an iPod on, and he had a smile on his face. And I just thought, well, whatever just happened, you know, it's pretty good. One of my favorite moments was in Paris. I think we were at Théâtre de la Ville, and Stefan and I would be very careful. We didn't want the sounds to get so loud from the pit that they would obscure the iPod stuff. And so I guess we're both, you know, he set up a wonderful system of collecting those sounds from city to city, and we're both kind of playing them, I think, through Max MSP, if that sounds correct. And we get really low, you know, because we always want to give it waves, you know, so where what we're doing is almost imperceptible. And he gets this confused look on his face. And I go, and I'm looking, you know, and I'm trying to be very quiet, you know, because the audience can see us if they look down in the pit. And I go, what's wrong? And he goes, do you hear that? And I go, what? And I start to listen, and all of a sudden, in other words, he was hearing a sound that he knew neither one of us were playing. And it sounded like crickets. It sounded like crickets. And what it was we'd gotten so soft in the pit that you could hear the leakage from everybody's earbuds.
Oh, that's so funny.
And it was the most beautiful sound. And I think either he said to me or I said to him, let's let this ride for a second. But it was just one of those, you know, I mean, Cage and Cunningham were so good at helping, regardless of what their collaborators were, helping people kind of set something up that would be even unexpected to them.
Yeah.
You know, but you got to be willing to go down that road. And yes. You always were, and Merce always was, you know, so I felt really, you know, when I was on stage with Merce, John Kelly, you know, the crew, I thought, well, it doesn't get any better than this. I mean, I'm on stage with Merce Cunningham. So if I never get to write music for him, that's okay. But then 2006 rolls around and that happens as well. And I thought, this is pretty cool.
Yeah. It's funny. I just remembered something, Michael. I don't know that I shared this with you, but your and Stefan's inclination to add local sound.
Yeah.
At the venues that you were visiting with the company. And I just remembered that when John Cage was doing his Harvard lectures. Okay. So that was taking place at Cambridge. It was taking place in, you know, right. Harvard. And we had finished it, and John had used in his source text all of the usual suspects, you know, people that he loved, Thoreau and Bucky Fuller and himself, and, you know, a lot of famous anarchists and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, and so one night Merce got home from work, and John wanted to read some of it for Merce and wanted Merce to, you know, give his opinion. So mm-hmm. he did. We were sitting there, Merce and I were the audience.
Yeah.
And when it was over, when John had finished, he wrote maybe a half hour, Merce made the suggestion that John think about using chance to determine excerpts from Boston-based newspapers so that current events would be in the mix, whatever was going on around Harvard. You know,
that's fantastic.
It was fantastic. So John was so agreeable to this that every day for the next, I don't know, 2-3 weeks, my job was using chance in the morning before I left Electra York's apartment on Waverly Place and walk up John. I would stop at that great newspaper stand that used to be on, it was like between 8th and 9th on 6th Avenue, or maybe 9th and 10th. It was on the east side
of the street. I know. I used to live on 14th Street. I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah, it was this great newsstand, and they had newspapers from all over the area. So yep. I could go there, and there was like 5 newspapers that were from the Boston area. So I got, you know, that day I knew which ones to get. I would get them, and then John and I together would use chance to determine which articles, what page, you know, and we would excerpt a little bit of that, and John would put it into the mix, and we would roll it into the mix. Anyway, it's kind of the same idea, you know.
Was this the Norton lectures?
I'm sorry?
Was this the Norton lectures?
Yes, exactly. He was the holder of the Charles Eliot Norton chair.
Yeah.
Yes, so the Harvard lectures or the Norton lectures, yeah.
And you told me a story about that. And I can't remember if you were sitting with people listening to John do this. And I can't remember if it was you who said it or someone you were with said it, but somebody said, in listening to this, which sounds fantastic to me, he said, have we all lost our minds?
Oh, that was the director. That was the director. And we had done the, I think, so John did these six lectures. There were six Norton lectures, which every Norton chairperson does six things. Okay. It was after we had done the first one.
Okay.
Cage had read the first one, 90 minutes. Yeah. Two things happened after he did that. We were walking back to a reception, and the I guess it was the dean of the humanities program. I could look it up to tell you specifically later. I probably shouldn't name names right now anyway.
That's fine.
But one person in the group, we're all walking, one person said, have we all lost our minds?
Well, I remember you telling me that story, and I just, you know, I just thought it was fantastic.
And another person, the other thing that I recall, with another person who was in charge, came up to me and he said, Dr. Kuhn, has Mr. Cage finished all of the lectures? And I said, I think we have two more to go. We're finishing up. And he said, could they be a little shorter?
Fantastic.
I said, absolutely not. For heaven's sakes, no. It was hard on them. But anyway, it was a brilliant idea, you know, because it brought Cage into a kind of contemporary space that in the through the text that he was reading in a way that it wasn't going to reach it by him. You know, the mandate to him or the program for him when he accepted this was to make his six lectures somehow autobiographical. That's really all they wanted.
Right.
And so his response was to make these misostic lectures using people's texts that had been of import to him his whole life. But that what did not include the Boston Globe, you know, or things like that. Anyway, it was very cute, but it's no different. Really, but then you and Stefan saying, let's put some Paris in here.
And he was such a, you know, his own composition, his own work deals with sound and field recordings. So he was just on fire with this stuff. And if I'm remembering correctly, I believe that he had either found this device or he had rigged it himself where he could have two little microphones attached to his glasses so that he could walk around kind of undisturbed when he was recording sound from the city and stuff, and people wouldn't know that he was sort of recording.
Wow.
And I and also it gave a little bit, of, if I remember correctly, a little bit of a stereo sweep. So I thought, you know, he was that he was the perfect collaborator for this piece. I was super grateful that he was game.
Yeah. Do you see him ever? I don't know where he is these days.
I feel like the last time we touched base was definitely about 3 or 4 years before, you know, I mean, before COVID. So I can't remember exactly when it was and what the context was. But we definitely had some kind of exchange, and he told me where he was and what he was doing or teaching, but I can't remember. Can't remember where it is.
Michael, we have about, I don't know, we only have about 5 minutes left. And I'm kind of hoping that you'll talk a little bit about your 433 installation in Miami. And the reason
That was fantastic.
It was fantastic. And the reason I'd love you to do that is that last week, my guest last week was Joan LaBarbera, who was a very important player in that whole 3-day festival. And for that particular festival, Michael was brought in to do some, he was asked to do something with 433 as an installation piece. What did you do?
So I was very fortunate that I was working on a piece at the Krannert Center that took a long time to come together with Ben Neal called The Demo, which was a sort of music theater piece or opera piece based on the original 1968 demonstration of computer technology. And the reason I bring that up is because every time I would do a show at Krannert, they would give me a new stage manager to work with. And every one of them that they ever gave me were fantastic. And the one that they, that Karen Quisenberry suggested was a young man named Austin Lynn, who was a computer whiz, but also was studying stage management. And so this was perfect, you know, Douglas Engelbart and The Demo with a stage manager, but my good fortune was increased because he was able to help me set up the live stream thing. And what we basically came up with was this idea that we set up a YouTube channel and people could submit their own performances of 4:33. And then we would fold those into, we made a matrix of different patterns. So sometimes it might be full screen, just one image. Sometimes it might be five, a large screen, a smaller screen or whatever. And then the algorithm would sort of choose. And this is where Austin was so important because I would have had no clue how to do this. And we basically had set this site up and everybody, I think you sent out info and I sent out info and he sent out info. And all of a sudden we were getting all these responses from people who were sending us videos. I mean, full orchestras. In fact, when Michael Tilson Thomas saw it, he goes, I know that orchestra, you know, it was just so hilarious. And so what was so beautiful about that 3-day festival in Miami is that they devoted one room that almost like a meditative room where you could go in and sit if you wanted to or whatever, if you were having intermissions between performances, you could go into that room. And it was a giant screen and it basically just rotated these hundreds and hundreds of performances of, you know, I mean, this one young ensemble on a subway platform doing it. I just thought it was a fantastic way to kind of honor the piece, and also it just showed such a variety of people who wanted to participate, from ensembles to orchestras to solo people to some people who I thought they just maybe thought it was funny. But you know, at the same time, John, I always felt that John Cage welcomed that, you know, so therefore I'm to this day I love looking at that.
It was a fantastic installation. It was perfect. It was just perfect. Yeah. And that, you know, very different than, you know, I talked about this on another show with Larry Larson, because Larry built the 4:33 app. So we have this app on it's a phone app where you can capture ambient sound. It's very different than that though, because this had this whole performative aspect to it. These were people performing 4:33.
That was a great experience. Getting to meet Michael Tilson Thomas was a great experience. And, you know, having Cuban sandwiches with you in Miami was a great experience.
It's true. Michael, it's been so great. So let's go eat Cuban sandwiches together soon.
I think we can make that happen.
I would like that. We should stop. I'm going to plug in several cuts, I think, from International Cloud Atlas. I'll do a broadcast page. I'll tell people how to find you on your website. Cool. Your Bandcamp, all of it. So people can get to know your music, maybe a little bit better than they're going to just from this one little program. But
fantastic.
Yeah. It's been an amazing ride, Michael.
It has. And I've appreciated every moment of it. Opened up a lot of doors for me. So thank you.
And you for me.
Now let's listen to a couple of tracks from International Cloud Atlas, which was conceived by Michael Rouse to accompany the Merce Cunningham dance iSpace. He thought it would be a perfect homage to Cage and Cunningham to have everyone listening on iPods, set to shuffle, of course, as they watched the performance unfold. Says Rouse of the CD, the sequence of tracks on that one recording represents but one version of his composition. As with the dance performance, the sequence may be set to shuffle to yield a possible 3,628,800 permutations.
Este lado está vazio. Quando este lado está vazio agora. Quando este lado está vazio. Quando este lado está vazio agora. Quando este lado está vazio. Quando este lado está vazio agora. When the este lado está vazio. Quando este lado está vazio agora. Quando este lado está vazio. Quando este lado está vazio agora.